Hey, this is Chuck Dixon, and you're listening to Signal of Doom.
Hello and welcome to Signal of Doom, episode 23. We've got a huge show lined up for you. It's going to be, we've got Chuck Dixon on the show. We've got an interview with Chuck that's going to be in this show. Got some news. Stu is sick. Deathly ill. No, he's not deathly ill, guys. He's got the flu or at most a heavy cold. And unfortunately hasn't been able to attend the Signal this week. So I'm just going to do Dave. My name's Dave. And I'm going to do a solo just wrap up of the news. And then we're going to lead into the Chuck Dixon interview, which I really, really think you guys will appreciate and enjoy. Chuck gave a fantastic portion of his time, and it's a good chunky interview. It's close to an hour and a half with Chuck Dixon. We cover a wide range of topics. We are doing Batgirl Year One. That will be scheduled till this Friday night because Stu is healthy or getting more healthy. I've seen a picture of the medical certificate holding a copy of today's newspaper. I'm assured the doctor's given him clearance. He will be back on Friday. But in the meantime, you're going to have me, D-Fin, running through some news items and kind of fast pace, and then we'll lead into the Chuck Dixon thing. Now, firstly, I've obviously been myself away. I was in New Zealand looking at the landscape, which was lovely, from a scenic railway tour, which reminded me heavily of Skyrim. And then when I came back, I've basically been playing Skyrim for about 4 days because I've been on leave. It's been fantastic. Some topics to report. We've got a fantastic email from Michael Kellersham, who also asked some questions, which I used in the interview with Chuck. So in honor of Michael and in Stu's absence, I'll read out this email from Michael just to kick the show off. And it's quite a funny one. So here's from Michael. Hot in the heat of the hottest news story of the year, Where in the World is Signal of Doom? Star Real News reporter Michael Kellersham tracks down the story of the whereabouts of the venerated podcast host. Reports have confirmed that host Dave Lois Finn travelled to New Zealand with lady friend Michelle and was ambushed by a horde of angry former Lord of the Rings extras hiding near the roadside in abandoned hobbit holes. The hobbits kidnapped Mr. Finn, demanding from the local government a ransom of $1 million cash or an advance screening of Thor Ragnarok. Faithful co-host, the main man Stu, upon learning of the hostage situation, attempted to persuade the Australian Prime Minister to liberate Mr. Finn by unloading a barrage of fire and fury, the likes of which the world has never seen. But upon reflection, realised no one really knows who the Prime Minister of Australia is. Some people in Australia don't know that either. Undaunted, the main man entered into hostage negotiations himself, successfully liberating Mr. Finn by bamboozling the out-of-work hobbits by luring them away to a phony casting call for a Willow remake. And now free Mr. Finn is reported to have celebrated his freedom by attending a movie with a large popcorn and Coke where he promptly fell asleep in the theatre. And that's the news, the real news, Michael. Well, Michael, as always, thank you for your email. Uncannily accurate, like just so accurate, my friend. I mean, it's like you were on the Scenic Railway Tour with me. Now, turning to other news, I do want to mention that some awesome new product has come out this week. There's the 90s trade, the Punisher 90s trade, Punisher Suicide Run is out in stores and on Comixology. We discussed that with Chuck. And also, Mike Baron has a really, really good prose novel, Domain, out now. It's horror. I read it while I was in New Zealand. It's horror with a sort of like artist in LA storyline to it of the main guy, the lead character. I really found it a fascinating read. I'm not a massive horror guy, and it was just a really good. It almost operates as a kind of a weird sort of slice of life drama as well of this guy's journey in LA. He's working storyboarding on movies. I really, really enjoyed it. So I'd recommend that. Now, turning to some news, we've got that Obi-Wan Kenobi movie is reportedly finally moving forward. Billy Elliot director Stephen Daldry is in talks, no cast attached as yet. They'd be crazy not to sign Ewan McGregor. I'm sure they will sign Ewan McGregor. And, I mean, it will be interesting to know where they go with a Obi-Wan prequel. Even if it ties into the same period of time that the Han Solo prequel will. Who knows? We don't know. I mean, I guess there's a good roughly 20 years that we don't know what Obi-Wan was doing, apart from being in the desert, being old man Kenobi up by the sand dunes, whatever it was. I do want to report this. The Dark Tower, I saw it. It obviously was a huge disappointment at the box office. I wrote a review on my phone just after I saw it. I saw it solo in an empty theater with a coffee in hand, a donut, and a large Coke, which is basically my dream of how to see a movie in a cinema. I was also paying discount work ticket prices, which was good. Decent first act and setup. The kid playing Jake does a solid job. Then, though, the movie takes a turn. The deeper it goes. Basically, for a while, I thought it was good. Not great, but just okay, good. Woeful final act that basically ends with a whimper and in a very rushed and very predictable fashion. The stakes seemed tiny and the drama was just extremely telegraphed. I had it for a portion of the film as a soft 6 out of 10, but in the end I'm struggling to give it 5. Like, it really lets itself down in the second half, and the closer it gets to the end, the worse it is. So that's not what you want from a movie. So, yeah, and like, at the best moments of this Dark Tower movie, it felt kind of like a clip show of a good TV show, like a sort of clip, you know, best of moments. It didn't have much substance to it. Like, a lot of ideas were sort of not even really thrown properly at the wall. You sort of glimpse them. I'm sure the property behind it is a lot stronger than what I saw on screen. And I think a TV show, if they do it, would probably exploit it better. But this isn't a good movie. I don't recommend paying full price. Now, turning to other news, we do like to keep our watch on Tom Cruise. Well, Mission Impossible 6 obviously is halted for up to 3 months, potentially, after Tom Cruise injured his ankle jumping between buildings. And, man, I watched this, and I felt bad for Tom Cruise. I mean, I know the guy likes to do his stunts, but Jesus Christ, like, sometimes I think, Tom, just count your money and let the stuntman do it. I know that's not him, though. He digs it. This is the guy from Hung from a Volcano in Mission Impossible 2. Almost fell off, almost died. I mean, if I had this guy's cash levels, I wouldn't be taking those kind of risks. But I guess that's what makes him Tom Cruise. And there is talk that apparently the movie may not be halted because they can shoot around it. Well, we'll see. I mean, he's mid-50s. It looked like a pretty solid, if you watch it, it's a pretty solid smash into the building, and he's limping heavily, and he's broken his ankle. So that's not gonna recover quickly. I would think 3 months is probably, with all the technology, I guess he's gotten all the access to all the funds, I could probably get him going again. But that's not going to be an easy heal, I don't think, depending on what the break's like, I guess. But yeah, turning to other news, David Tennant is back on Jessica Jones, spotted filming. Defenders is obviously debuting now. Michelle and I have watched the first 5 episodes. We're really enjoying it. I won't give any spoilers because it's only just come out. But I mean, if you're digging the Netflix shows to this point, I think you'll enjoy this one. It's very much in the same mold. I'm really enjoying it, like, personally. I was watching it last night. Michelle fell asleep. I powered on. you know, I mean, I'm like, come on. Like, we're 3/4 into the show. She's asleep, or maybe even a half. To me, she's committed to a certain point. I've got to finish it off. Daniel Craig is back as Bond. This is his final outing. I'll believe that when I see it. He confirmed it on Colbert. I mean, honestly, I'm glad he's back. He's a good Bond. He's obviously being paid a fortune. I just hope they make a good movie. I mean, he's a very, very good actor, and he's turned in out of the Bonds he's done. Casino Royale and Skyfall were awesome. Quantum of Solace was terrible. And the last movie, I've honestly tried to watch like 3 times. Spectre, I've fallen asleep every single time. It can't be good. I'm falling asleep. I know I fall asleep. I know that's my reputation in movies, but this is like, I'm falling asleep in like the first 25 minutes 3 times in a row. I have no idea what happens after the first 25. I've seen the first 25 minutes of Spectre 3 times, and it's not exciting. So that's not really a positive review, I don't think. So I hope that they do something bigger than that. Turning to the next news, Millerworld, Netflix has acquired them, all of Mark Miller's properties outside of, I think Kingsman and something else, a couple of properties. Pretty much most of the Millerworld stuff has all been acquired by Netflix for, you know, first look deals, so that'll be interesting. We've obviously got the sad news. Ryan Reynolds revealed that basically a stunt woman died on the set of Deadpool 2, and filming has been shut down indefinitely for that. She was doing motorcycle stunts. Not good, obviously, and our hearts go out to her. James Cameron says Stephen Lang will be the villain in all 4 Avatar sequels. I mean, am I hearing crickets? Is anyone interested? Does anyone care? I love James Cameron. I've gone on record many times as saying he's a fantastic director. He's got whose movies have made billions and they've been really enjoyable, like Terminator 2, Aliens. Give me a break. They're just fantastic. But, you know, Avatar, I mean, the dust has settled from whenever it screened. It feels like 10 years ago. It was probably more like 8 years ago. Stephen Lang's going to be the villain in all four? I mean, really? Okay. I guess we'll see what happens when it comes out. I really hope that when Avatar comes out, it blows me away completely. Because I did enjoy the original when I saw it on a visual basis. Not a storyline basis, but just visually stunning. So I imagine that, again, he's going to hit us real hard. This is James Cameron. He's a genius. So we'll see what happens. Disney have set up their own streaming service, dropping for the Netflix deal from 2019. And also are setting up a multi-sport broadcasting deal from early 2018. That's interesting. I mean, there's such a vast amount of Disney product that I imagine if they have it all exclusive on their own channel, I'd be interested in that. Now, I'm just doing sort of like a fast track of the news today, so I'm cutting over some stuff that I normally would discuss with Stu, because he'll be back on Friday, and we'll do a really, you know, a full in-depth discussion then. Turning to the Neuromancer movie, being directed by Tim Miller. I mean, this has been a long time in development. I read Neuromancer back in, like, the 90s. To be honest, I didn't. Although I've read my fair share of William Gibson, I've never really loved the actual writing style, but I do find him fascinating, and the story's kind of fascinating, and I definitely think you could make a really good Neuromancer movie today. Like, you could really do it very well. And, I mean, Tim Miller was the director of Deadpool 1. Yeah, I mean, bring it on. Like, I mean, I don't want to sit around thinking and talking about it for years. I want it to actually happen. We've also got the ongoing saga of Ben Affleck as Batman. I mean, this story, it's not even interesting layers, it just has chapters of just, it feels like negotiation being played out in front of the public. Casey Affleck weighed in, saying that his brother wasn't doing Batman, and then seemed to realize he'd put his foot in it and did, oh, but I'm just making up as I go along, I don't really know anything. Okay, well, thank you, Casey. Sit back down. Ben Affleck had an extensive quote about Justice League as well, and talking about how it's got two directors now. Zack Snyder obviously stepping away due to family tragedy, and Joss Whedon coming on. Just to quote Affleck, it's a little bit unorthodox, admits Ben Affleck. Zack had a family tragedy and stepped off, which was horrible. For the movie, the best person we could have possibly found was Joss. We got really lucky that he stepped in. Wasn't really luck. I'm sure he was paid. Affleck describes the resulting film as an interesting product of two directors, both with unique visions, both with really strong takes. I've never had that experience before making a movie. I have to say, I really love working with Zack, and I really love the stuff we've done with Joss. Well, thank you, Ben. Maybe you could run for, you know, Congress with this kind of like political answer. Look, I mean, obviously, I'm a slave. I'll be obviously, no matter what happens, I'll be paying my money to see Justice League. So take everything I say with a grain of salt. There's rumors that Joss Whedon is changing the Justice League ending big time, and he's ratcheting up the, I guess you could call, dramatic interplay between the characters while they're retaining a lot of the action scenes as Zack Snyder directed and shot. Sounds good. We've spoken so much about, I'm looking forward to Justice League. I want to see what happens. This ongoing saga of whether Ben Affleck's going to be Batman. I mean, his reps came out and walked back Casey Affleck's ridiculous comment. And he just said he's contractually obligated to one more solo movie and he'll do it. Like, you know, and it's like, okay, well, thank you. I noticed that they really, even in all his, like, oh, I'd be an ape in Matt Reeves movies, I'd do whatever it takes. He's never said, I'm doing a trilogy. He just keeps going on about, I've got one more on the slate. You know, at a certain point, I don't mind Ben Affleck, but he's not really showing a lot of, I guess you could say, enthusiasm for Batman. Like, it's like, I've got one more on the slate. You know, yeah, I'm congratulatory obligated. Yeah, no shit. So just shoot the movie. Anyway, I just can't spend any more time thinking or talking about Ben Affleck and Batman. It just annoys me. I liked his performance in Batman Superman. I thought he was pretty cool. But could he be replaced if he had to be? Yes. I mean, frankly, yes. Any actor who can punch a line, who's got a strong jaw, can play Batman. Good looking, reasonably tall, with a strong jaw. and a decent voice. This is a lot of actors we're talking about. Not even household names. A lot of people could play Batman. Anyway, some stuff that we'll talk about more with Stu on Friday, because I'm sure he'll have his own opinions. And believe you me, in a normal show, people, if this is your first Signal of Doom episode, I don't normally get to just rap through the news like this. I have Stu normally attacking me as I present the news to the audience. It's kind of like a heckler as I'm trying to Lois Lane report. But this time, Lois has a direct conduit to the listeners. So I hope you guys enjoy it. Robert Kirkman and his Sky Brown imprint quit AMC for Amazon Prime. So the Amazon Prime, I believe, gets a first look deal at all his projects that aren't currently on AMC. So obviously, Fear the Walking Dead and Walking Dead stay at AMC. He did have Outcast. I don't know if that's still going, but that also would stay there. But everything else is now first look on Amazon Prime. And also, in sort of related news, him and other Walking Dead producers are suing AMC for breach of contract over, I believe, royalty deals. Yada, yada, yada. You know, it's not the first lawsuit that AMC are defending on the Walking Dead property, because if you remember, Frank Darabont has had a long-going dispute with them over him being fired off, I believe, season 2 of The Walking Dead. And I still think that's before the courts now. So, a bit of litigation there. There's obviously a bit of money around. Turning to, I'm really doing an impressive job of getting through the news, if I do say so myself. Look, we're sort of onto the comic book news, and I'll just give this briefly, because just for the Moon Knight fans out there, for Into the Night podcast, I know you guys are huge supporters of the show, and you are referenced in the Chuck Dixon interview. Moon Knight Legacy is being launched with Max Bemis on writing duties. He's done some acclaimed work on the Fool Killer series. And apparently he's a lead singer on a band, Say Anything. I can't say that I've ever heard a single song by Say Anything, but I do know it's a title of a movie from the late 80s, so good for them. Bemis has experienced bipolar in his personal life, bipolar syndrome, is it? And will bring that experience to bear into treating mental illness in the scripts for Moon Knight. Okay. And I know the guys and girls at Into the Night are pretty pumped about that, and I think it sounds very interesting. So we are definitely ready for another, you know, version of Moon Knight, because there certainly has been some really interesting takes of Moon Knight in the last, you know, few years. I can think of Warren Ellis. I can think of, was it Jeff Lemire? Jeff Lemire's run was exceptionally good with, I think, Declan Shelvey on art. Fantastic stuff. And just finishing off on the news, comic news, Jim Lee had lunch with Jonathan Hickman, which made the news sites. So I guess we're reporting about it on Signal of Doom, so it's really getting to the mainstream. Like, I mean, honestly, look, you know, I was going to say who cares, but I mean, I'm sure some people care. I'm sure that, like, look, it would be cool, I guess. Like, Jonathan Hickman, I guess, no one at Marvel, then he's gone to Image, had a lot of success at Image. I mean, I like a lot of Jonathan Hickman's Image stuff, frankly, and I love his Fantastic Four at Marvel. It would be cool to see him at DC doing something. What that is, we don't know. I mean, who knows what kind of money Jim Lee's throwing his way. I imagine a fair amount. Now, look, that really wraps kind of, that's a very fast-track version of the news. Now, Stu and I, on Friday night, will come back with a big show. So this is just, consider this an entree, consider this just the soothing sounds of my nasal voice. We did do weekly comics, and I do want to mention, I read Mr. Miracle, which I loved it, and I don't care. Mr. Miracle 1, Tom King writes it. I mean, I don't care about the New Gods, like, really. I mean, they're okay, but I'm not a big fan. But this Mr. Miracle comic was I thought it was almost perfect. I would recommend this. People are always like, if you're looking for something from DC that's a bit different, I'd recommend this. I really thought it was good. Yes, you do need to have some knowledge. I know the basic beats of the New Gods, but they're not that complicated. Like, you've got Highfather, you've got Mr. Miracle, you've got Big Barda, who I believe is Mr. Miracle's wife, and you've got Orion, who's just a jerk, but he's like the sort of, oh, he's just your sort of tough guy on the good guy side, but he's just he's in this episode as well. I really enjoyed it, and I'm looking forward to more. Red Generations, All New Wolverine and Wolverine 1, not good. Red Generations, Phoenix and Jean Grey, I don't know, this Generations thing where, like, It's so thin a concept. I expected, I don't know what I expected. I don't know why I expected something better, like, really. But it's just like the current version. I like X-23 or Wolverine or whatever you want to call her. Like, I like her, and I like Tom Taylor. Like, so I like them in general, this character and treatment of character. But she just appears opposite Wolverine in a sort of nondescribed time period for a very generic kind of adventure. Like, it's just filler is what it is. Like, it's not that bad or anything. Like, it's a 6.5 probably out of 10. And I just expected a bit more because we haven't seen Wolverine. Obviously, he's been dead in the comics for some years now. And, like, Old Man Logan just doesn't cut it for me. As Stu says, be frozen yogurt, be ice cream, will be nothing. Like, Old Man Logan, yeah, so close to the real deal, but just not it. You know, so no thanks. And Generations, Phoenix and Jean Grey, it was okay as well. Look, it was actually pretty cool. I think if you're a really big X-Men fan and really enjoy Phoenix and Jean Grey, you'd probably get a lot more out of it. I didn't mind it. It's actually quite good. It's probably better because it's a bit more dramatic. But again, it's filler. Like, it's something you'd have in, if it was Christmas, you'd have it in the little stocking that's kind of like just the sort of junk stocking, if you know what I mean. It'd just be in there. Just here's an extra one, kids. This is what you sort of get free. It's a free comic almost. It is what it is, but Generations is totally, as events, I wouldn't even call it an event. I wouldn't even dignify it with that term. It's a marketing stunt is what it is. As a marketing stunt, it's okay. It's kind of like, it really reminds me if you bought a paper back in the old days and you used to get like a free comic in it. It's kind of that level of quality. Like, it's forgettable. With that said, Batgirl Year One, I have read it. I discussed it on the interview with Chuck. But Stu and I will review it and discuss it properly on Friday night for our next show. But I mean, I love it. I talk about it in the episode with Chuck Dixon. So on that note, I'm going to leave you guys. I've come in. Oh, look, I've come. Stu said do 25 minutes. Well, Stu, I went fast track. I gave it everything and I've come in under 25. So there you go. Just goes to show we normally stretch this out to 2.5 hours. I got it down to 21 minutes. Okay, look, I love you all very much, and we look forward to seeing you next time. Enjoy the interview with Chuck Dixon.
There must be some kind of way out. Here, say the Joker to the thief. There's too much confusion. I can't get no relief. Businessman there, drink my wine. Plowman, dig my earth. None will level on the mine. Nobody of it is worth.
Okay, we're on Signal of Doom, and I'm here with acclaimed comic book writer and author Chuck Dixon. Chuck's the co-creator of Bane and many of our favourite Batman and Punisher comics, amongst many others. He's also the author of the Levon Cade novel series. Chuck, welcome back to the Signal.
I'm glad to be back. Thanks for having me.
How's Florida treating you, mate?
It's humid.
So, is it true that
But it's Florida, so everything's good. It's Florida. It's okay.
Is there gators in the streets, or is that a myth?
No. Yeah, you will see gators in the streets. I have seen gators in the streets. Not very often.
Sure.
But they're here. Well, they're in every single body of water has at least one. So.
Well, that's full on, man. Like, I mean, people say about Australia, they're always like, you see kangaroos hopping around in the city, and you don't. But in Florida, you do see gators in the streets.
Yeah. Out here in the suburbs, you know, we moved into their territory, and there's water everywhere. Just in my community alone, there's two lakes, and they got gators in them. Just have to be careful. Luckily, they're not crocs. Crocs would be a different story.
These are smaller, aren't they? They're actually just smaller versions?
No. They're huge. We get 10, 12, 15 footers, but they're slow. Alligators and crocodiles are not the same animal. Alligators are very, very slow, and you kind of have to get in the water to be in danger. But, you know, as you guys know, with crocs, they can be anywhere.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, they can be in the swamps and stuff. Yeah,
yeah,
yes,
they're fast.
Yes.
They're vicious. Alligators aren't like that. They'll sort of lay in the water and wait for a bird to get close.
Got it. Because we've done crocodile tours up here in, like, Queensland, like far north, and they'll tell you that if they see an opportunity, they'll grab it. You know what I mean? Like, they're ruthless.
Oh, yeah. I met a Seminole Indian alligator wrestler once, and I said, did you ever wrestle a crocodile? And he said, do I look crazy?
I love it. Now, Chuck, turning to what's going on, I mean, Bane Conquest is out. We've got 4 issues out so far, and you've got issue 5, I believe, coming out early September. Now, how's it been going? I've been really enjoying it. What's the reaction been like from fans and from stores?
Enthusiastic, and the sales are steady. Sales are a good thing. So
definitely,
seems like everybody's happy with it, and you know, we're having the time of our life. So
it's great to see you and Graham Nolan back at DC and putting out such, you know, quality work. And everyone I've spoken to across various different podcasts and fans, everyone's really pumped that you're back and with Graham and that you're producing. Like, I think it's almost what audiences want at a certain period of time. Like, they want good old fashioned action comics at times coming from DC. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think they want them all the time, but that's just me.
Well, you're supplying it, Chuck. You know what I'm saying?
What I do.
Yeah, I've actually got the gig now at Batman Universe of reviewing Bane Conquest. It's fallen to me. So
cool.
Yeah, I know. I also do Jimmy Pomiati's book with Amanda Connor, Harley Quinn.
Okay.
Yeah. So I've been doing that for a while, and they go out fortnightly. And I've been doing Nightwing and Harley Quinn fortnightly, and I've got to be honest, it's a grind reviewing it fortnightly. I enjoy it, but I'm like, how is it writing and drawing this on a fortnightly basis? Like, it's intense.
Yeah, you got to start early. I've done the fortnightly schedule, and it's you just have to stay way ahead of schedule.
Yeah.
So because you can't let time catch up with you because there is no time.
Exactly. It must feel like you're always got... I've heard as well that with Fortnightly, I've heard from other creators that basically you're writing, say, an issue 17, but only issue 14 is coming out and you're also working on 15. Like, you're working on multiple things at once due to the schedule?
Well, if you're working on 17 and 14 is out, you are way behind schedule.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You got to be way... I mean, I'm going to start Bane issue 11... this week.
Oh, okay. And, so you're right up there.
Yeah. And Graham has started issue 8. He started issue 8 on Thursday last week. So
got it. Right. Okay.
But that's us. I've always liked to stay way ahead of schedule. I was a year ahead of schedule on Nightwing. I was a year ahead of Scott McDaniel.
And that must be a good feeling, especially when you're doing so much like you were. Like, I mean, and you've got all these different books. You need to sort of be doing that. Otherwise, you'd be just forever against deadlines just every single
second. It's the only way I could do so many books. And I still do that. I'm still way ahead of schedule on everything because it leaves room in case somebody says, hey, you want to do this? I go, yeah, I got the time.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I've got 3 months because I'm ahead on everything.
Now, I've got a question for you, Chuck. What's the process for you at the moment with your foot back in the door at DC? Are you pitching for new titles at DC, you know?
Like
Graham and I are talking about it, and I'm talking about a couple of things with a couple of other artists, you know, about pitching stuff. But, you know, I don't have the kind of relationship. I don't even know what kind of relationship I have with DC personally these days, because I really don't know any of the people that I'm working with. I've never met them.
Sure.
Back in the day, back in the 90s, I lived only an hour and a half outside of New York, so I visited once a month. And I mean, I got to know everybody, and I knew all my editors personally, and still talk to them to this day, you know, via email and phone. But these guys, there's no personal relationship, so I can't take the temperature of how they feel about me.
Sure, but I imagine your name must still carry some weight, like they're aware of who you are, and like they look at the sales.
Oh, yeah.
Sure, you know.
They certainly reprint enough of my stuff. I mean, you know, they know who I am. That's not the problem. Or maybe they know who I am is the problem.
So. That's too funny, man. I was going to say, I was thinking, because I was reading Bane Conquest 4, and Catwoman's just singing off the page to me. Like, as soon as she appears, I'm a huge Catwoman fan, and just Graham drawing her and you writing her, I'm like, man, I am so into it. And I'm just thinking, there's a character. I don't think that there's a monthly title out for Catwoman right now. I don't think there's been one for a while. I reckon that's something, you know, if you want a suggestion, I think that's the kind of, you know, territory where, I mean, you've done Catwoman in the 90s, haven't you? You did for a while.
Yeah, I wrote, they would use me as the fill-in guy between regular writers. So I ended up, they changed writers a lot, so I ended up writing maybe 12 to 18 of them. And I love Catwoman. She's the only character in comics who is comfortable in her own skin. She actually likes herself.
She's fantastic. You're so right. And like, when you did it, if I remember correctly, I want to say his name, I'm not trying to pronounce it, is it Jim Ballance? Art meshed with your storytelling. I mean, it was honestly just really cool. You know, like she was so, I guess, confident, as you say, and sort of almost sexually aggressive and confident as well, and just none of that moping around. Like, she was a really fun character.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I liked about her. I mean, she liked what she was doing, and most superheroes are such gloomy gusses, you know. She liked it, and working with Jim was a blast because he's a character himself. So
right, yeah, he's a great artist. I mean, it's classic stuff. I got my hands on one of the old trades recently, just through some Facebook connections, and it really was. I just picked it up and started reading and started leafing through it. Did you ever read, I guess it's in the early 2000s, did you ever read Ed Brubaker's take on Catwoman? Because I thought that was very impressive as well.
I read, so that was with Darwin Cook, right?
Yeah.
My last Bat Summit, Ed just started on that
stuff. Got it, right.
And he told me that on the, at least on the Darwin Cook stuff, that Darwin basically did a lot of, took a lot of liberties with his script art-wise, which Ed was happy about, because, you know, that's genius stuff.
What a talent was. Like, he's so missed. Yeah. He was just so good. Do you know what I mean? Like, Darwin Cook, it's just, it's sad, I guess, you know?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's sad that we don't have him with us anymore, because he was such a powerhouse as a person and a talent, but also sad because I felt that they never used Darwin to his full potential. I know he felt that way too.
Oh, really? That's sad. Yeah.
Darwin was a game changer, and no one seemed to realize that.
Wow, those people should have read. Was it New Frontier? Because that blew my mind. You know, when it came out, it was just if you couldn't recognize Darwin Cook was just a massive talent from New Frontier, you're struggling. Like, it was just so. I saw he did some covers. Probably a few years before he passed away, and it was just all different covers of different things at DC. He did one of the Teen Titans where they're playing in a band.
Right.
I've had it on my Facebook as my profile for all, you know, at various times. It's just so beautiful. Like, he just captures all the different characters.
Well, the thing is, I think they recognize that he was a talent, but the problem particularly at DC is they look at projects as milestones, and they... It, like, you know, Watchmen is a milestone and Dark Knight Returns is a milestone and New Frontier was a milestone, but they didn't realize that Darwin could do that every month. You know, that wasn't like the high point of his career. He didn't see it that way. Mm. It was just a project, you know, that he handed in and it did well. And I think he wanted to get into the monthly comic thing and really start changing things around.
Yeah.
And they just don't think that way anymore.
That's weird, because I would have thought, I mean, I'm talking from the outside, I would have thought him, a name on a book, I mean, he would automatically have been selling you know, a certain percentage more than, you know, many another artist just based on his reputation. Like,
oh, sure, yeah, sure. Yeah. But they didn't have to, you know, they didn't know how to utilize it.
Yeah.
And he knew how to utilize himself because he would, I mean, I talked to Darwin quite a bit, and he would have all these, you know, ambitious projects that he wanted to do, but he couldn't get anywhere. And it always reminded me of, I read an interview with Tim Burton once, and they said, what's the thing that still surprises you about Hollywood? And he said, how hard it is to get something greenlit.
Yeah.
Which you think, what? And that was the thing with Darwin. He couldn't get them to go with the ideas that he wanted to go with, which were all winners.
Yeah.
And the sad thing is that a couple of times they went with the projects after he proposed them, and they went with them with other people. They liked the idea, but they wanted him on something else. I mean, they were hitching a racehorse to a cart.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear what you're saying.
You know, that's they didn't use him right. And I think it was a great frustration to him. Certainly a great frustration to me. And now it's a great frustration to anyone listening.
Yeah. Well, all I've ever seen from all the other different creators is just total love for the guy. So he seems like he was an amazing guy on top of what an amazing artist he was, you know?
Yeah, he was a magnetic personality. When Darwin started telling a story, you sat down and listened. You know,
cool.
I spent many an hour, you know, where I hardly did any of the talking because the guy just had a... just a magnetism about him.
Hmm.
Just an amazing personality.
Well,
and
man.
I'm really, you know, we you know, everybody in the industry misses him.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, gosh. Well, Chuck, coming from that, I've actually got a question for you, and it was kind of related in Bane Conquest. I saw Batman Turns Up. Always good to see Batman with Bane. I like the way they sort of, like, it's a marriage of convenience in the issue, if you know what I mean. Like,
right.
I've got a question for you, though. What do you think of the current Batman design with the yellow outline around the Bat logo, and what's your personal favorite design for Batman's costume?
My personal favorite is just the classic. Well, the revised classic of the 60s with the yellow around the bat symbol and the yellow utility belt.
And what, you know, color just, is that, the blue or the black?
The blue, yeah.
Oh,
the blue.
Really? Yeah.
The blue and the gray out. Just the classic, you know.
Yeah.
You know, just with the addition of that yellow thing around the bat. But the the current one, I mean, it's okay with me. I mean, it still looks like Batman.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know how Graham feels about it, but it still feels like Batman. I don't have to draw it.
Yeah, for me personally, I mean, I come from that Frank Miller thing where it was the grim and gritty, but I have a huge affection for that blue cape and cowl, like from the 70s.
Yeah.
You know that look?
Yeah.
It's just with the right artists, that's just such a beautiful look. And sometimes I'm like, we're so determined to always push the black armor. I'm like, which is cool, but why not sometimes kick it back to the blue, you know?
Well, for my money, I like to see him, and I did this when I was on Batman, put him in all different kinds of outfits, whatever outfit. I mean, I've had him in camouflage. I've had him in, you know, armor. I've had him in pressure suits. I mean, you know, he's got a costume for every occasion. I mean, that comes from my own personal love for my favorite Batman story ever, the thousand costumes of the Batman. and, you know, he's just got a closet full of these things.
And I mean, they love that for action figures, too, because that means they can go, you know.
Oh, yeah, that's a cash cow.
But, exactly.
But, you know, and that goes back to what I was saying, you know, you can do a lot to Batman, and he always looks like Batman. As long as he looks like Batman in silhouette, you're cool.
That's exactly right, mate. Now, Chuck, I think one of the most interesting things about talking to comic book creators is hearing all the different routes they've taken to make it in comics. And I think I once heard you saying that you started pitching around the time of the DC implosion. Can you explain to Can you explain to listeners what that implosion was and how you ended up breaking into the industry?
Well, comic sales crashed in the 70s, and, you know, it was so bad that this is how bad it was. Marvel went on what they called an austerity program where the artists were drawing the art to size. They were drawing the art at the same size as the comic book to save on paper. That's how bad it was.
Oh, they weren't doing the bigger version, which they normally do.
No. They were actually having them turn the original art sheet sideways and drawing two pages on each sheet. To save on paper, and then DC went the route of laying off 40% of their people, just sending them home and doing a lot of reprint collections and stuff like that to save money. And they were caught in a bind with the newsstands and shrinking sales, the news agencies and shrinking sales. And that's when I decided to go up. Well, I was out of high school, so I had to go up and start looking for work.
You heard there was a job going, and some people had lost their jobs. You're like, you know what?
No, I never heard there was a job going. It was just I want to be in comic books. You know, it's like I want to be in vaudeville. Well, it's 50 years too late, kid. So I. At that time, you couldn't get an interview. What they would do is they would come, have you come up on Wednesdays after lunch, and they would take and they would gather all of these wannabes in the lobby, and then they would take you in a conference room, and two associate editors would just give you the bad news. You know that that it's the end of comics.
It's all over.
Yeah, find another career.
Wow.
But I didn't give up. I kept. You know, going at it.
Because that must have been confronting for a kid with dreams of trying to break in. And you hear that, you're like, okay. What, Superman's not selling? Like, what the hell?
Oh, yeah. When they told us the sales figures, I think one guy cried. I mean, it's terrible.
Wow, and was that because of like, I mean, I have no idea what comics cost back in those days. I assume like a couple of bucks probably or something. Like,
I think at the time they were 75 cents.
So they were quite cheap, really. But, I mean, maybe it was a tough economy
that was
as
the
well.
Problem.
You know?
Actually, the cheapness was the problem because newsstands didn't want to carry them anymore because they were cheap and they were taking up space the newsstand that a more expensive magazine could take up. And that's when both DC and Marvel started putting out dollar editions, and Marvel moved into magazines, remember, at that period.
Right.
Trying to put a more expensive product on the stands.
I see. Right. And so from that, when you got that news and you're like, okay, where did you wind up? Because didn't you wind up at Marvel in the end? Like, so how did you sort of get there is what I'm trying to get to.
Well, I kept going up to Marvel over and over again, and Archie Goodwin was nice enough to, you know, let me have interviews.
Okay.
But I really wasn't getting anywhere.
Mm.
And then I met Tim Truman, who was at the time was working at Eclipse.
Right.
And he introduced me to Cat Ironwood and Dean Mullaney, and I started selling them horror and science fiction stories for their anthologies that eventually got Airboy. At the same time I got Airboy, Hilary Barta, an artist here, a great artist, told me that Larry Hama was putting together a war and Western anthology at Marvel.
Okay.
And so I contacted Larry and submitted some stories, and he bought a bunch of stories and then started recommending me around Marvel to other people. So it was like simultaneous – Airboy and Larry Hama at Marvel.
And you started to get some traction then, you know, so that's good.
Yeah, enough, you know, eventually I got Savage Sword of Conan as a regular gig, and I was able to quit my, you know, daytime job and go full-time comics.
Oh, right, so Conan, because I was going to ask you about this. So, I mean, I'm a massive fan of, I'm not a huge fantasy guy personally, but I'm a huge fan of Robert E. Howard's, like, Conan stories.
Same here.
They're great, aren't they? Like, they're so underappreciated in today's world. People think Conan, as good as Arnie was, there's so much more to the actual stories, if you know what I mean. Like, and were you guys doing, like, interpretations of those stories, or did you do your own stuff as well? Like, I mean, I don't know.
I didn't do any adaptations. I just riffed off of what Howard had done.
So you were coming up with your own stuff based on the character. Yeah.
Yeah, and I didn't like, I'm like you. I'm not a fantasy guy. I don't like that stuff, you know. And I certainly didn't want to write it. And you know, so it would get to the point where I would do like three issues, and Larry says, "You know, we haven't seen any magic or monsters for three issues. You know, it's just been, you know, Conan fighting guys."
But Conan hates magic. You know, like
yeah. And so I talked it over. Gary Kwapis was my artist at the time. Mm. We became good friends, and I said, you know, I'm having a problem with this magic thing. And Gary said, well, I don't mind magic as long as there's a price to be paid.
Sure.
You know,
yeah.
It's not just abracadabra and there's no consequences. And I said, you know, that's the hook I'm going to use from now on. And that's what I did.
That's a good idea. Because otherwise it's Dr. Strange just, you know, he wins too easily sort of thing just by clicking his fingers, you know, if you don't do that.
Yeah. And then Larry, like 4 months in, Larry said that Marvel had found out that the Lovecraft universe had gone public domain, so we could start using that kind of stuff
awesome.
In our stories. And that opened the whole, because I was a Lovecraft fan, that opened a whole new world for me on the book. So no problem with Wizards and Monsters now.
Yeah, because that Lovecraft stuff, it's amazing, because if my research is correct, he was actually friends, Robert E. Howe was friends with him, and uses some of the stuff in the short stories, you know, the Conan stories, uses some Lovecraftian sort of like overtones at times.
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Mm. But you know, now we were given free rein to use Cthulhu and Dagon and all that stuff.
Oh, that's awesome.
So we were able to. Yeah, I mean, it's a perfect marriage because they knew each other. They were both published at the same magazine, and it just makes sense that they shared the same universe, fictional universe.
Yeah, it's one of those cool. It's one of those cool sort of working partnerships, isn't it? That they just happen to be around the same time, you know.
Yeah, they were part of what Lovecraft Circle is what they called it.
So. Oh, cool. Okay. I sometimes wonder, like, this is going to sound, I mean, I'm almost embarrassed to say this, but, like, I've said this to Stu on the show, but my co-host Stu has to listen to my rantings. And at times, like, I've said to him, like, when I'm reading, say, Sandman or Lovecraft, I've gone, Stu, do you really believe it's real? Like, you know, behind it all? And he's just like, he's a science guy, a teacher. And he goes, no, Dave, I don't. He's just like, no, Dave, you know, take another pill. No, it's just called a good story.
but that's how compelling it is.
Yeah, exactly.
Because I know at 14 or 15, you like to play with the idea, you know, when I was reading them, of like, you know, hey, could this be real?
Exactly, you know? Exactly.
Could Lovecraft be onto something?
Yeah, I know. Did he pay a heavy price for his knowledge?
Yeah.
Now, Chuck, we're doing actually on the Signal this week, we're doing Batgirl Year One, and so we've just basically just read it. And I've just got to say, I think it's just so expertly done. Obviously, you co-wrote it with Scott Beatty. Fantastic art by Marcus Martin. Just want to say there's certain stories about characters where both the characters and the readers would be a lot poorer without them, and Batgirl Year One qualifies in that category. It is amazing. So what I want to say is when you put this one together, you guys obviously put together a fantastic package. Do you remember much about that one, Chuck? Like, why Barbara Gordon? What was pushing you to do Year One for her? And, I mean, I honestly think the art is some of the best art I've seen in comic books. I absolutely love the art. Like, it's like, I've not seen anything by this artist other than this story, and I reread it, like, yesterday in preparation for the show, and it's got panels in it, and along with the story, you know, the breezy sort of story. So what? Take us back to that time period and what you were doing and you and Scott coming together to do this great story.
Well, Scott was the driving force to do Robin Year One. It seemed like a natural, and we did that with Javier Pulido.
And I love that one as well. That's a good story.
And when we wrote it, we wrote the first issue because it was broken up into, I think, four prestige or three, whatever.
Yeah.
And we wrote the script, and then we saw Pulido's art, and we went back and rewrote the script because we realized how much he could carry the story visually.
Yeah.
You know, so we eliminated a lot of dialogue and then rewrote scenes more visually driven, and which worked out. And then same thing with Marcos. And so we went into Batgirl Year One knowing how we wanted to tell it. And I mean, Robin Year One was very successful, so there was no problem getting Batgirl Year One.
Oh, Robin came first, and then it kind of led the way.
Robin came first, yeah. And then Batgirl Year One was even more successful. It's the only book I've ever done that sold more copies as it went along. The sales went up. You know, usually they go down after issue one. Yeah, they went up with each issue. And Marcos, I agree with you. Marcos' work is just so elegant and on the money. I mean, the book reads. I mean, I forget I wrote it because visually it reads so seamlessly.
It's got a breezy feel to it. Like you fall in love with her personality. And you are right. If it's visually one of those comics where it's almost just a visual treat, like you could just read it like almost like a sort of painting, like it tells the story from just panel to panel.
Exactly.
That's great. I always have thought it must be depressing for comic book writers when they hear that the number one issue sells like 80,000 and then it just steadily goes down. Do you guys just have to block that out? Like, you know?
I did a creator-owned book at Marvel called Mall Dog, and they sent the royalty check for the first issue with the royalty check for the second issue. And the first issue was $10,000, and the second issue was like $280.
Ouch.
And I remember calling the artist on a Flynn Henry, good friend of mine, crazy guy.
Is this Mall Dog you're talking about?
Yeah.
It's great. I called Flynn
on the phone and I said, he lived in an apartment building. I said, get down to your mailbox. There's royalty checks. And so he took the phone with him and I hear him open the open it up, and he goes, "Oh my God!" And I said, "Now look at the second check." And he goes, "Ah!" And he started this string of profanity. And I said, "Look," I said, "look at the bright side. They sent them both at the same time." Yeah. I mean, if you spent 30 days thinking you're going to get another big check,
he's gone out and bought himself another TV,
exactly.
New car. I've got to say, it's such a coincidence you mentioned that, because I've been researching for this interview and looking at some of your, you know, I guess as a creator-owned work, and that this Law Dog, it's brilliant, like, but it's crazy, Chuck. Like, what were you on, like, when you're writing this? It is actually, I would have to say, I've read, like, a lot of comics, like a lot of Grant Morrison, a lot of stuff from everywhere. This Law Dog, issue one, may be the most bananas comic I've read in a while. It's great. I love it. Like, it's great.
It's all, you know, as I tell Flint over and over again, I couldn't have written that book for any other artist. It's totally Flint inspired. I wrote the ultimate Flint Henry book.
It's
because he's nuts. He's out of his freaking mind. And, you know, he'll draw anything that I ask him to draw and then add more to it because he's compulsive. Yeah, I was just looking at the splash page for that one issue. The title was Death in the Fast Lane, where the splash page is freaking amazing. There's like a million zombies on it. With the title of the story worked into the art. It's just, he's crazy.
It's great. And you guys sort of re-released that issue one a couple of years ago, didn't you? Because that's where I stumbled across it. Am I right? Like,
Yeah. I dipped my toe into digital comics.
I see.
You know, and also we get a lot of inquiries from television and movie people about it. I wanted one place where they could go see it.
Oh, yeah, I think it's a great idea. Yeah.
Yeah. I got Gary Kwapis to recolor the issue and everything else. But we're talking now about reprinting the whole series with new color.
Oh, that'd be great, Chuck, because I can tell you what, I happened to read it like literally today, just in preparation for this again. And I was just like, it is beautiful. Like, it's great. Like, you left at the end going, I wonder what happens, which is just what you want. You know?
Well, we knew that we knew issue 10 was the end. So we kind of came full circle, but yeah, there's a lot more story to be told.
There was a
Law Dog one shot special, which never got completed when the book was canceled. But, you know, maybe someday we'll see that too.
Exactly, man. Now, just before we wrap up on Batgirl, there's the fact that it's a prequel, and we as readers, I guess, know the tragedy which awaits Babs with the Joker. But I really noticed that you guys don't oversell that. Like, you see the Joker very briefly mentioned, but the tone is the opposite of doom and gloom. Was that important to you and Scott as writers to give it sort of more of a breezy sort of light feel?
Yeah, I think that Scott and I share the same loathing for killing jokes, so we didn't really want to reference it.
Yeah,
just having the Joker show up was enough. We didn't have to step on that at all. That
exactly.
Readers knew. Oh,
yeah.
But we didn't want to bring readers down. We wanted to show this. You know.
Yeah.
Like you said, breezy. Breezy is the perfect word for it.
I've got a note here. The end where she swears the oath and Batman tells her the reason for it all and shows a parent's grave and, you know, accepts her into the family. That actually gives me chills with just the beautiful backdrop. I mean, that's actually a pretty heavy emotional payoff for such a beautiful, breezy tone of a book. Like, that's, I don't know, like, you've done so many comics, it must just, you know, there must be thousands of them, but I think this one is one where I think people really should put up. I've got the collection with Robin and Batgirl together.
Yeah.
A pretty thick collection. I got it a couple of years ago. It is a classic, and I really recommend to listeners, if they haven't seen it, to check it out now. I believe you also did Nightwing year one. I think I picked that one up when it came out. Was that from you as well? Yeah.
Scott Beatty and I as well. Mm. And Scott's the one who came up with the brilliant idea of having Dick Grayson meet Deadman.
Oh, okay.
It had never occurred to anybody. They both had circus origins.
That's very true.
And then, of course, Deadman's outfit inspires Nightwing's first costume.
The disco costume.
Yeah, that's what Scott brings. I mean, Scott brings a lot to the party, but those continuity connections, the guy's a freaking genius. He really
clever.
Is.
And I remember, and I'm remembering back when this is back when I was getting singles, doesn't he go and see Superman, and Superman tells him, I don't have any plans for a sidekick kid, or something like that.
He
just basically brushes him.
Yeah, because, yes, I mean, that was kind of coming off of Kelly Puckett, the Batman writer, he established this relationship between Dick Grayson and Clark Kent. I, I thought was awesome, and I used it as often as I could. I would reference it. I just thought it was a great relationship the two of them had. And then, of course, Batman's suspicion about their relationship.
Batman's jealousy.
Well, Kelly wrote a story, and at the end of it, Dick Grayson has met Superman for the first time. It's a flashback story, and he comes back, and he's Superman this and Superman that. You know, he's just, what an awesome guy. And, and Batman, last line of the story is Batman just turns to him and says, remember, he's not human.
Exactly. You can just imagine Batman glowering over the Batcave, can't you, as he's talking.
that was brilliant, brilliant.
I love it. Now, Chuck, I've got a question for you as a Bat writer. And I'm looking for your personal opinion, not just the current editorial stance at DC, whatever they tell you guys to, you know, do. Where do you stand on, does, you know, Jim Gordon, Commissioner Gordon, know in his heart of hearts that Batman is Bruce Wayne? And by extension, does he know that Babs was Batgirl? Like, where are you on that? Because I've sort of seen different, you know, people have different opinions on that.
I like to think that he doesn't suspect that Babs is Batgirl because he would put a stop to.
You would think so, yeah.
But we used to work under the conceit that Gordon could know if he wanted to know who Batman was.
Yeah.
He's a good enough detective that if he wanted to know, he could find out, but he decides not to.
He sort of chooses not to, sort of thing.
Yeah. He just turns a blind eye to it.
Because I remember it's in No Man's Land. I think it's somewhere in No Man's Land towards the end, I think. Like, Batman literally takes his mask off and he's like, turn around. And he's like, no, I won't turn around. I don't want to know, sort of thing. I thought that was a very interesting way to deal with it.
My take on the whole thing is, why would you even wonder who Batman was? I mean, in a real world, if there was a Batman, wouldn't we assume he's Batman all the time?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And we certainly wouldn't go, I think my neighbor is Batman.
Yeah, he'd just be too awesome.
That bothered me.
Like, no one, you would think no one could be as awesome as Batman would be what you'd be thinking. Like, this is just, there isn't like a person, like an imposter, sort of like a Bruce Wayne playboy. You probably wouldn't look there in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, if you hear on the news that a masked bandit robbed a bank in your area, you don't immediately think, I think that was my ex-high school teacher. You don't start thinking of wondering who it was.
Exactly.
You just say, why would I know who that was?
Very true. Now, Chuck, here at The Signal, we've got sort of close ties to a Moon Knight podcast called Into the Night, and they're big, great friends of the show. They alerted me to your run on Mark Spector Moon Knight back in the late 80s. So
yeah,
I checked it out. A couple of great team-ups with Punisher and Spider-Man. Now, you've worked with some great artists, and Sal Velluti on art.
Sal Velluto.
Oh, fantastic artist, man. I mean, it just must be such a pleasure when you're working and having someone like that who just tells the story just so perfectly.
Well, that's the real joy. I mean, I get as big a kick now out of seeing the artwork as I did when I first started in the business. I mean, it's just a thrill, you know, to see what these guys do with what I wrote. You know, and it always a surprise because I picture the pages in my head. They never come out the way I pictured them, you know, but they're always awesome.
Yeah,
you know, it's a matter of interpretation.
Now, I've got a few questions that the guys are throwing me, but I want to say first up, I've always said Marlene is one of the greatest girlfriends in comics. Feisty, but so supportive and obviously attractive. She must have been fun to give some scenes to during your run.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I like strong female characters.
And she's very strong.
Yeah. I've never been drawn to the, you know, girl hostage thing all the time I like my women, you know, tougher.
Yeah, exactly. With a little bit of feistiness. Like, it's good. We've done previously on the show, just before we lead into these questions, previously on the show we did the Doug Munch and Bill Sienkiewicz epic collection, which was a complete trip, very enjoyable. So we've got some questions here. Now, my first question about your run on Moon Knight is about the multiple personalities. I noticed when I read through the Punisher crossovers that Mark Spector isn't suffering his usual split personality issues, and I was wondering, was that a conscious move by yourself to differentiate from prior runs, or was he just on his meds?
That was editorially driven. Carl Potts was my initial editor, and he thought that the multiple personality things took away from Moon Knight.
Sure.
So he told me to write. Now, Doug Mensch will never believe that. Doug Mensch thinks that I decided to take away the multiple, but I didn't.
I was the editor.
So he'll always, in interviews, I don't get very good treatment from Doug in interviews when Moon Knight comes up. But,
oh, dear.
You know, it wasn't my fault, you know.
Blame Carl Potts.
And then it was my idea to lean more into the mercenary.
Got it.
As a former mercenary. So that's how that happened.
Cool, man. So one of the questions that the guys are throwing, and these guys are hardcore Moon Knight fans, so I'm much more casual. Like, I don't mind Moon Knight, but, I mean, these guys are hardcore. So the first question is, as a definitive Batman and Moon Knight writer, how did you write the characters differently? Is there any validity in the claim Moon Knight is just Marvel's Batman?
Well, he doesn't have to be. I don't think he was when I wrote him. Mm. He wasn't grim.
He wasn't very tortured, was he? The ones I've read, he didn't seem too tortured.
No. He was an adventurer. You know, he was a thrill seeker. Yeah. You know, he was a former mercenary. I mean, there's got to be a personality there. I didn't write him like Batman. I mean, it wasn't even a practice thing for me for writing Batman.
Yeah, yeah.
When I did a short run on Green Hornet. And that was a practice run on Batman for me.
But Moon Knight,
I didn't see as the same thing.
Fair enough, man. If you were to return to Moon Knight now, I don't know if that's likely, what stories would you want to tell, is the second question. Do you wake up at night with more stories for Moon Knight?
No. I wake up with Punisher stories. They're the only ones. But Moon Knight stories, no. After I left the character, I never really thought about it again. I suppose today, the mercenary aspect is even more... prevalent, even more relevant, with all of these, private security companies, the private paramilitary companies. That'd be a perfect world for Moon Knight. I mean, there's freaking war everywhere.
Oh, exactly. We live in it just seems like endless conflict around the globe that a mercenary could work in, get stories out of.
I think you're on the only continent on the planet where people aren't shooting at each other every day.
Long may it continue, Chuck, I say.
Yes.
Now, here's another one. Your favorite Moon Knight runs. Have you actually read the Doug Moon stuff, like, at any time? Or?
Oh, yeah. I read it when it came out. Yeah, the initial ones, the ones that would run in the back of, I think it was Rampaging Hulk magazine. Those are my favorites.
Oh, okay. That's where it started, did it?
I was
very, very impressed when I read through his epic collection with Bill Sienkiewicz. I thought they were really pushing a lot of boundaries. I obviously only read it like a couple of months ago, and my co-host kind of a bit more of a slog than me, but I always liked the street level sort of stuff. And I just fell in love with Marlene. I spent a lot of time rhapsodizing about Marlene because I just think she puts up with a lot. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. I mean, especially in that run.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Very true. There was a Moon Knight Punisher Spider-Man team up, Chuck, that you did that looked like a lot of fun. Was it fun at that point in your career working with Spider-Man? Because you seem to be having a lot of fun with Spidey in those issues.
Yeah. I mean, the challenge for me with Spider-Man was his dialogue, because he's a wise ass, but it has to be funny. The thing is that in that crossover, I remember right, Punisher gets all the laughs because he says stuff off the cuff that he doesn't mean to be funny, but it's funny.
Punisher's awesome in this one. He just he's almost like a special guest star. You know what I mean? Like just chiming in with stuff.
I just remember that the bad guy ends up crushed in a car crusher in a cattle pack.
And everybody's
horrified, but Frank says, boy, what a waste of a caddy.
Yeah, literally everyone's there, and they think Punisher's like, let him off, and Punisher just like destroys him. I loved it. I want to give a shout-out, Chuck, to a little character you put in the issue called Anarchy. She's just this young woman with cool wraparound sunglasses, a bit of a homicidal nut, but I liked her energy. And Punisher says, this one's more dangerous. She's in it for the fun. You've obviously done like 1,000 characters. Do you remember Anarchy? Does that ring any bells?
Not really. That was a long time ago.
Man, I haven't looked
at them in a long time. So.
I put it in honor of this interview, I actually put Anarchy as my profile pic today. and I'm just waiting for someone to tell me that's their favorite character.
Well, it will be. Yeah. Every character is someone's favorite character.
Exactly. I have a ridiculous attachment to some of the side characters at Marvel. One of my all-time faves, Chuck, I don't know if you're familiar with her, Diamondback. She switched sides to Captain America. Yeah.
Great character. I had Diamondback in a couple of stories.
I don't blame you, man, because she's never shy about telling old Cap what she thinks, which I like about her. Like, she's bothered to switch actual sides just based on who she wants to date. That's what I like. That's literally her allegiances, how she swings. Like, just who does she want to date? I will change sides.
Right.
And it, like, seriously, if I was going to, I've actually thought about this. If I was going to pitch to Marvel, that's the kind of character I think would be so awesome, because it's a surprise character. Only a few people know about her. You could do a lot with her. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, the name is great. You know,
that's great. So. And she looks great. It's a fantastic costume. It's iconic as hell. Someone on Rebecca on the Into the Night thing, she said she's tropey as hell. And I said, Rebecca, I think I'm tropey as hell. let me love her, like, you know. Now, Chuck, one of our listeners on The Signal, Michael Kellersham, he's a great friend of The Signal and a big fan of yours, and he submitted some pretty good questions. In fact, he's outdone himself. He sends me some great emails. He's outdone himself with these questions, Chuck, so strap in. They're pretty good. The first one is, what is the status of the Winterworld comic and the proposed TV show?
The comic is tied to the TV show, you know, going into production.
Got it.
And like everything else in Hollywood, it's, you know, one step forward, two steps back.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So right now, I don't pester IDW with questions like what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Like every 6 months, I'll go, hey, what's happening?
Sure.
And things are happening, but, you know, they're happening slow.
It's like glacial with Hollywood, isn't it? Like, it's very slow, you know.
It's a nightmare. It's a nightmare. I mean, there are. It's a wonder anything gets made.
Yeah. No, I hear you. And then it has to go to pilot and get, you know, accepted, et cetera, et cetera. Like, it's a long process, you know.
Yeah, I was talking to someone this week, you know, household name, Hollywood guy.
Yeah.
And he was saying, you know, he was telling me about this project that he wanted to work with, and he liked this stuff, and he wanted to use something of mine. And and I said, yeah, that's great. And he goes, well, you don't sound too enthusiastic. I said, well, you know, you've been in this business a lot longer than me.
Yeah.
You know, you don't get enthusiastic at this point.
Yeah, just talking about it, like, we're a long way from it. You know,
right.
Seeing any checks.
Right.
Chuck, question two from Michael. You once this is an odd question. You once said in an interview you teared up while writing a Raggedy Ann and Andy story. Where can fans find this story so we can cry along with you, Chuck? I'm having trouble with the question. I don't even really know what Raggedy Ann and Andy is. Toys, I thought. Dolls is what I thought they were. But
Raggedy Ann and Andy are they were a series of American children's books back at the beginning of the 20th century.
Okay.
And they're still in print now, and they've been cartoons and comic books and, of course, dolls.
Right.
And I wrote a I don't know if you have them in Australia. They're called Little Golden Books. They're little picture books.
Oh, we did have them. We did have them when I was a kid, at least, anyway. Yeah, that rings a bell.
Okay. I wrote one called Raggedy Ann and Andy Go Flying. And it's under the pen name Mary J. Fulton, which because they didn't want a guy named Chuck Dixon writing it. And the Mary J. Fulton's name comes from my grandmother on my father's side and my father's middle name.
Oh, well, God bless her. So, and you were so moved by your own work, like you were just.
I liked Raggedy Andy. I was into the property before I wrote this, you know,
and
I just sort of got a little misty. Oh, writing enough. This one scene because wow. they're just so sweet.
they're just so goddamn sweet. Well, there you go. Michael's got his answer. He could go and hunt down the little golden book. Now, question three. This is an interesting one. What would your pitch be for the Fantastic Four from Marvel?
Simply me and Graham.
Yeah, I was going to say pretty simple. We're attached
pretty
to the
simple.
Property.
Me and Graham. You know, and that would be it. You know, that's all I would need.
Yeah.
And we could. I picture a weekend spent up at Graham's place in Buffalo, New York, and we hammer out a year's worth of continuity and just attack it.
And I don't think at the moment, I think that Fantastic Four doesn't have a comic book out. I think it's a little bit political because Fox owned the rights to the movie characters and yada, yada, yada. So they're not putting out the, you know, the monthly Fantastic Four comic. I don't think at this point in time they're currently doing it.
They've got this peculiar strategy of basically starving Fox of any kind of recognition, trying to erase the Fantastic Four until Marvel can bring it back themselves. It's a weird strategy.
Yeah,
I don't quite understand.
It's a stupid strategy. Like, I mean, if I'm going to be editorializing here for a second, the last Fantastic Four movie was terrible. No one saw it. It didn't do anything. You know, like, you could have a comic book that could be doing certain numbers that, you know, with or without that movie. I don't quite see them, like, it's not like Fantastic Four are this massive property at Fox they're just going gangbusters, right. You know.
Yeah. Right. But you know, it's dog in the manger time when you're dealing with these studios. I mean, Marvel wants the property back, and, sure. and Fox is going to hold them up for everything, every penny they can get to let before they let Marvel have it back.
There was a rumor we reported on the Signal, because we sort of do a lot of comic book, you know, movie news as well, like a lot of, you know, the rumor mill and stuff. There was a rumor, one of the rumors was they were going to do the kids, the Fantastic Four kids, Valeria and, I believe, Franklin. And the other rumor was, to keep the property alive, they were going to do a solo Doctor Doom movie.
Jeez, I don't know. I mean, you know, they come up with so many ideas, you know, and by the time the limo ride is over, they've forgotten about them.
Yeah, I know.
You know, I mean, you just wouldn't believe how much stuff gets thrown around out there. And then somebody hears about it and thinks, oh, my gosh, they're going to be casting soon. It's like, I know. And even when they're casting, even when they found the locations, even when they're 2 weeks from principal shooting, it can all get canceled.
George Miller out here in Australia, when he was shooting Justice League around the same time as the Christopher Nolan movies, he was almost up to actual, you know, properly shooting, and they pulled it. Like, it can get that close. Well,
look at Neil Blomkamp with the Alien movie, and they yanked it out from under him. He was coming, you know, he was, you know, getting ready to do principal photography.
What's his name? Ridley Scott was doing Alien Covenant and wanted to keep his hands on the property, I believe.
Yeah. I mean, they basically just took it away from him. Well, what was it? Wolfgang Peterson with Batman versus Superman. You know, that back in the, maybe 2002?
Right, okay.
You know, that was far along, and they yanked it. So, you know, who knows why they do it? There's a lot of petty rivalry and...
The dancing that's going on around Affleck, if he's going to stay as Batman, I'm so sick of hearing about the speculation. Like, his brother came out the other day, Casey Affleck, a well-known douchebag as far as I'm concerned. And he,
I could tell you stories.
Yeah. But he just came out and said, oh, you know, Ben's not doing it. And, oh, but he goes, oh, but I'm just making it up as I'm going along. And it's like, really, why are you talking? Like, you know, what are you trying to do?
Well, and my answer to all of it is, who cares?
Yeah. No.
You know, you get someone else. Like, there's no one else that can play Batman. I mean, you know, it's Ben Affleck, for God's sakes. Yeah. He can be replaced in a heartbeat by some guy we never heard of before.
Very, very true. The Batman role, I mean, if there's one role that's been shown that multiple actors can play it, it's Batman, you know?
Yeah, you know, and if it's been shown that multiple actors can do a bad job at it, it's Batman.
Oh, dear. Who is your favorite cinema Batman, by the way?
Keaton was great, because the key to playing Batman is Bruce Wayne. I don't like the movies, but he was great. I like Keaton anyway, but he played Bruce Wayne so perfectly, and none of them else captured Bruce Wayne the way I think he should be. So
What's his name? Christian Bale did a very serious take. Like, it got a bit too serious for me. You know, at a certain point, there was no levity at all. You know, like it was just constantly that voice, and I was just like, this is getting. If I was in Batman's like Bat family, I might be like, you know what, I'm going to take a pass. I'm a bit sick of hearing about this voice. now. We're not finished with Michael's questions. The last one, and this is a tough one, Chuck, and good for you if you can get an answer here. If Marvel's Western heroes went up against DC's Western heroes in a shootout, who would win? I'll turn that over to you, Chuck.
DC's Western heroes are meaner.
Yeah.
Marvel's Western heroes are based off of, you know, 50s cowboys, you know, Roy Rogers, stuff like that. DC's heroes come right out of spaghetti westerns and Euro westerns, and they're just, you know, Rawhide Kid or Two Gun, they wouldn't shoot you in the back. Jonah Hex would shoot you in the back and step over your body.
I was going to say Jonah Hex, that's the only one I know, and he's a badass. You know?
Yeah, it was Jonah Hex. There was, El Diablo? I'm trying to remember them all.
Is there one called Vigilante? I only know him from the Justice League cartoon.
Oh, Vigilante was like a. They turned into a Punisher character in the 80s, but he originally was. A Western. He was a modern Western hero. He rode around on a motorcycle.
I only know him because he's in Justice League cartoon at some point.
Back in the 50s, he rode it. Because Roy Rogers at the time had a TV show where he was driving around a Jeep instead of a horse. So they modern day Western.
Wow, so, okay. They took it into the current time period at the time.
Yeah. It's like, I don't know why.
Didn't he have a horse? Was his horse called Trigger? Am I right?
Oh, yeah. His horse was famous. It's stuffed somewhere.
Yeah, cool. But, who wants to see Roy Rogers in a Jeep? Nobody.
No. No, I think the toy companies wanted to sell Roy Rogers Jeeps, personally.
I think so, too. Well, that's the end of Michael's questions. I think you've done very well. They're pretty tough. He writes in some awesome emails. We know we've got another question from the Serious Issues podcast page, which is a podcast out here in Australia. And Adam asks, what's the run, Chuck, that you're most proud of, if you have to, you know, go through all your comics?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's a tough question, I know.
Yeah, that's a tough one because, I mean, I've had a lot of great runs. I mean, my run on Savage Sword with Gary, Detective with Graham.
Yeah,
Green Arrow run with Rodolfo DiMaggio.
I love that Green Arrow run. It's good.
Yeah. I'm the luckiest guy in the world. I got to work with so many awesome artists.
Yeah,
it's hard to pick one.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, they're like picking a children or something, isn't it? At a certain point, you know.
Exactly.
I mean, these questions are tough.
And if there are any artists listening, I probably offended all of them. You didn't mention me.
It's not fair. Blame Adam. Okay, now the last question is from, I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, Shigeya Demir, who asks, this is actually, I think it's a joke, besides comic book Bane, what's the Bane of your life? I just think it's
the tax man.
Yeah, it's the tax man. I thought you might say deadlines.
No, I don't have a problem with deadlines.
No, you're good with deadlines. Yeah,
no. The tax man. I want to escape him.
Fair enough.
Broken my back a few times.
Yeah, he never goes away. Like, even when you're dead, he still keeps coming. Now, Chuck, we've talked off air briefly about 2000 AD, and I just wanted to bring it up. I first read 2000 AD in the late 80s. Basically, I was very impressed when you said that you've collected it or had collected it since the beginning and actually had the original issues.
Yep.
Am I right?
Yep.
Now, can you take us back, Chuck, which I assume was to the 70s and 80s. How did you access 2000 AD back then in the States? Was it on the racks next to Superman? And how long did you keep going with the title?
No, I think I saw it. We had a newspaper here called it was a tabloid newspaper called the Comics Buyer's Guide. It was like a collector's publication.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw it mentioned there, and then I contacted a guy that I had met in England through collecting.
Got it. And right. I see.
He sent copies to Alan McKenzie, in fact, who ended up working for 2000 AD.
Okay.
And he would bundle them up. You know, he would wait a few months and bundle them up and send them to me. And we would trade.
I would
send him American comics. He would send me British ones. So I saw Judge Dredd from the beginning.
You know? Man, that's awesome, Chuck. Like, I mean, and it shows what a deep interest you had in comics, because I imagine that wasn't sort of on everyone's lips at the time back in the States. Because what I've noticed when I've done a little bit of reading of sort of comics in the, you know, for American comics compared to comics coming out of 2000 AD, the 2000 AD comics seem a little bit more adult and darker and just more edgy in general. In that period, maybe would you agree?
Oh, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, there was a level of cynicism in those books, and there still is. Mm. And also, the thing about 2000 AD that was so different was the British writers working on them threw out ideas like crazy. I mean, they just threw ideas out. Every page had something startling or amazing or inventive on it.
Mm.
And then they would just move on to something else. You know, they didn't even fully exploit the ideas they were throwing out there. It's just they were so eager to entertain.
And they were on a weekly, they were on a weekly comic thing, weren't they? A weekly release date. I don't know how guys like John Wagner and Alan Grant did it. Like, I mean, they must just have lived and breathed, and the artists as well. They must just have been working like an absolute slave to get it out. You know?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm. I mean, I know Alan personally, met him and talked to him about Judge Dredd many times.
Mm.
And yeah, it was just, they were just on a high. They were just as totally running on enthusiasm.
It's awesome. So, I remember my first issue when I was about 13. It had Kano from Bad Company on the front cover looking absolutely psychotic. It had Judge Dredd, Chopper Goes to Oz, ABC Warriors with Simon Bisley on art, and obviously Bad Company in there, and I think some Nemesis as well. That was a lot for a 13-year-old mind to take in one issue, you know?
It is. That's just it was mind-blowing to me as an adult. I can't imagine it's a kid seeing that stuff.
I've seen recently Peter Milligan, who you probably know, has recently gone back to 2000 AD on Bad Company, and James Robinson is now writing Rogue Trooper, which is interesting.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, I did not know. I'll have to talk to my son follows it, so I'll have to talk to him about it.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't follow him anymore, but I know he gets it.
Yeah,
so, well, it's easier to get here.
I believe the James Robinson announcement. Yeah, the James Robinson announcement came out like a couple of days ago, which because he's a good writer. I always follow James Robinson, you know.
No, he's very good.
Yeah, he is very good. He really is good. Is that no question I've got for you, actually, and I'm really just thinking aloud, considering like Judge Dredd or the ABC Warriors, is that something you've ever considered at times in your career of working for 2000 A.D. or Rebellion? Have you actually thought, you know what, that could be something that I do?
I've brought it up a number of times because, you know, I know guys on the editorial staff there, known them since they were fans. I bring it up all the time, and I always politely get put off.
Oh, really? That's a shame.
I think it's because I'm an American.
Yeah, and, I was going to say. Yeah.
People will say, well, John Byrne did one. Yeah, he's a Canadian.
Because, am I right in saying Peter Milligan and James Robinson are both from the UK originally, aren't they, I think?
Yes. Yeah. Everybody on that book is from somewhere in the UK.
So it's basically it's a national thing. You just can't get a gig due to your residency.
It's a closed shop, but I wanted to be on Thread. I tried out for Dredd here when IDW publishes an American version of Judge Dredd.
Yes.
But Rebellion insisted that even though it's the American version, they wanted English writers on it because I wrote a pitch for IDW.
Fair enough, but, man. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, hey, I'm working for Benelli in Italy. They don't care if I'm American.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you've got work. It was just an idea. By the way...
Oh, no, I'd love to do it. I'd love to do it.
There's rumors they're getting closer and closer to a Judge Dredd Netflix show with potentially Carl Urban attached. That's something we've been following on the Signal, actually. That's edging. That would be something special, I think, because I think Judge Dredd would really suit a TV show, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. My son and I check the internet every day to see if that's confirmed.
Oh, okay. Right. So I'm not breaking news to you.
but I'm saying just at the level of enthusiasm here for it, because we've watched that movie I don't know how many times.
That's good, isn't it? The Dredd one with Carl Urban, it really is a good movie. Yeah,
It is. It's something worth popping in any time.
Yeah, definitely. So. Now, Chuck, let's talk Punisher for a second. Punisher Suicide Run has just come out in trade paperback, and it's on Comixology this week, and I think it behooves modern-day Punisher fans to check this out. This is Punisher back in the 90s, Chuck. You were obviously heavily involved. I've got some questions here. I just want to make this point, and I want to see your sort of thoughts. To me, Punisher, as you guys were drawing him and writing him back in the 90s, was the ultra example of a concerned citizen. Definitely damaged goods, but highly functional. And I got this quote, Chuck, from one of the Moon Knight Punisher team-ups. You wrote, you say, Punisher is different. There's no rage. This is a job to him. His emotions punch a clock. He calls them up when he needs them, if he ever needs them. I mean, that's badass, Chuck, you know?
Oh, thank you.
Like, give me your view, because I always like how you say women are my weak spot. That's what Punisher always says in a lot of your stories. Like, he's got this sort of damaged version of almost a white knight complex. Is that how you saw it with Frank?
Oh, absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. I mean, he's not... You know, his cynicism doesn't spread to women. He's, you know, I think all women remind him of his wife.
Exactly. And, yeah.
You know, and so that's a blind spot.
Yeah, and I guess, like, I'm thinking of one-shots, Chuck. I don't know if you remember on Punisher War Journal, like Armageddon Express. And one of my personal favorites, Chuck, is Good Money, where he crosses paths with these gangbangers in a car. Then he has to waste the woman who hitchhiked with him after she's killed the other criminals following an armored car job. And, like, he thinks that she's innocent. He thinks that she's, you know, whiter than snow. And it all goes horribly wrong, and he has to gun it down.
It's the only place he makes assumptions when it comes to a woman.
Yeah.
So, and they're always wrong.
Yeah, I know. Poor Frank.
Yes. Well, poor all of us, really.
Yeah.
Because we all make assumptions about women, and they're always
true.
Wrong.
That is true. Do you know what kind of numbers Punisher would have done at its peak in the 90s? Like, when you were on Punisher Warzone, say with John Romita Jr., or when you were on War Journal, do you have any idea what kind of numbers it was doing?
Well, Punisher Warzone 1 sold 3.5 million copies.
Seriously?
Of course. Yeah, of course it plummeted after that.
Okay. But, that's a lot, though.
It sure is. I signed them and Robin 1, I probably signed more of than anything else.
Yeah.
Because there's just so many out there. But the numbers on the regular Punisher books, Journal and Punisher, I think they were in the 175,000-200,000 range.
Which is huge, really. I mean, when you look at books today, I think a lot of books, like even top books like Batman, he might go over 100K, but a lot don't get anywhere near that. You know, like, I mean, it's quite common, I believe, for books to be even under 20,000 now.
Yeah, you know? And Punisher wasn't seen as a bestseller. I mean,
really?
There was always concern over its sales. So we were always having to do stuff to, you know, guest stars and things like that to keep the sales level.
To pump it up. One thing I noticed, Chuck, is the editors weren't afraid to spin Punisher across his multiple titles, and the tone of the titles and issues varied from very structured, like some of the Carl Pott stuff, to a more raw experience. What was the scene like back then in the Punisher office, Chuck? Like, was there strong editorial guidance? Because it seems like you're a pretty hungry bunch of guys hustling. Is that what it was like?
Well, Don Daly is probably the most peculiar editor I've ever worked for. I always say there's two kinds of editors, and then there's Don Daly. Mm-hmm. He was Don. This may mean something to you and some of your listeners, but Don Daly was a drummer, mm-hmm. and he had a drummer's personality. Everything always had to be in movement. Mm-hmm. And to give you an example, when Don Daly was fired from Marvel, in his flat files in his office, they found $500,000 in inventory that he had assigned to artists and writers. I have an entire graphic novel that never saw the light of day.
Really?
And the artwork done, lettering, everything. And but he would call me to give me an example. My first son was born. He called me the day before my wife was due and said, "I got this idea." And I said, no, I'm going to the hospital with my wife tomorrow. We're going to have a baby." And he goes, oh, well, then I'll call you tomorrow. I said, "No, I'm taking a month off of work. I'm all caught up with my deadlines. I'm taking a month off."
Yeah.
And he kept insisting, no. And I never did. He had to wait 30 days before I would let him tell me about the story idea.
I like
but,
it. It's
but he
kid,
was, he was
it?
Like that. Yeah. He was driven. He was driven. He's a high school teacher now, which I guess those kids are having fun. He is one spastic dude.
I mean, I've got to say, he may have been eccentric, but the guy knew how to push some great stories out there.
Oh, no complaints. He knew how to challenge me. He would come with the craziest ideas and say, "No, you can make this work. You can make this work." And he had faith in me, and that's the thing every writer needs, every creator needs, is somebody with faith in them.
Exactly.
No, he was awesome. He was awesome.
That's cool. Now, I know you've obviously got a soft spot for Punisher. Like you say, that's the one character, you know, that you still would have ideas for, even though you're not writing him currently. Do you keep in touch with the character? Like, for example, did you have a look at what Garth Ennis was doing?
I looked at some of the stuff that Garth did. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's tough. It's like watching your kids go off with somebody else. I mean, I know I didn't create the Punisher, but, you know, comic book writers tend to get possessive about characters they wrote. And really don't check out what somebody else did. You know, rare occasions. What Garth did was interesting. I mean, Garth is it's in his DNA to write Punisher, I think.
Oh, he did a great job. Like, I mean, it brought me back into comics, actually. Like, I'd sort of checked out. You know how you check out at times? And I sort of thought, what's happening with Punisher? I just checked out, like, that was a man called Frank. And it drew me back into comics because he really did do a good job.
The Punisher escapes a lot of writers. They don't get it, and he got it.
Yeah.
So
that's cool.
You know, I think the concept is so simple that it flummoxes writers. They overcomplicate it.
Yeah, because it is such a simple concept. Like the way you wrote it, I'm reading the story and I'm sort of thinking, and I don't mean to sort of, I'm sort of like, man, this seems like it's so natural a story. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't seem complex, but that's why it works.
I mean, he's not a detective. You know, there's no mysteries to be solved or anything else. He's a guy who creates all of his own problems. You know, he just thinks he's a living, deconstructed plot line. Just as soon as he enters the story, everything gets worse.
Now, look, I know you don't spend a ton of time on modern superhero comics, especially when you're working with a publisher, but doubtless, Chuck, you became aware of Captain America and then Punisher becoming Hydra/Nazi in the mainstream Marvel U. What was your take? And I mean, I had plenty to say about it on the Signal, so my take's on the record. What was your take on the situation as someone who had lived in Frank Castle's head for a while? Did you have a reaction?
I just thought it's a stunt. Yeah. You know, they do this stuff every once in a while. I mean, when I was on the books, I wasn't writing that line, but when I was on the books, they turned him into an African American for a while. I mean, you know, it's like, literally turned Frank into an African American. It's like, okay, but it's a stunt. It's just comics.
Yeah.
That's what comics are. They're raw. They're crazy. They're out there.
Yeah.
People shouldn't get all bent out of shape because, you know, it'll all be back to normal eventually.
That's true.
Like, you know, when Superman died, you know, who believed he was dead?
Yeah.
You know, it's crazy.
He was dead for like a good half hour, you know.
That was our challenge on Nightfall, was to make
people believe maybe this is permanent.
Well, I think I've told you before. I remember back in the 90s, I used to get a little stoned. And I was sitting there and they told me, so the news filtered down to me that Batman's back had been broken. And I was like worried. I was like, this is a serious issue. Like, we need to get to the bottom of this. We need to heal him up. And like, the whole thing about the Azbat coming in, I'm like, this guy's taking drastic measures. Like, right, I don't know. Right. I was a pawn in your hands back then. It was really funny. And I mean, I guess that's what you're trying to get, though. Like, the reader out there who is living and breathing it, like on a weekly or monthly basis, like they want to be entertained. Let's face it.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That's what I go for anyway.
Yeah. Now I've actually got a theory, and I sort of want to get your thought on this. I've got a theory that the decompression of modern day storytelling drains a lot of the tension out of the story. So we're being sold like 2-year plot lines as slow builds. It's really just storytelling at a snail's pace. So, for example, the concept of Captain America turning Nazi for a surprise arc is more palatable in a 3-5 issue arc, but you drag it on for 18 months, it's suddenly a lot tougher sell. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, it's you know, it's like, when are we going to get to the end of this?
Yeah, exactly. Like,
and it's not decompressed the way manga is. It's decompressed the way a soap opera is.
Very much, you know, so.
Where,
yeah.
Where it's like, you know, remember what we talked about yesterday? It's like, well, why am I reading this? Why yeah. Why was this scene necessary?
Like,
you know, it's
yeah.
like you guys get the DC TV shows over there, Green Arrow and Flash and everything else. I mean,
yeah.
Every episode there's a long scene where two people talk about someone who's not there. It's like, this is decompressed storytelling. Why is this scene necessary?
I honestly think that, like, this is just, you know, my view as a reader. And even as a storyteller, I think that like, even on titles that are good, like with good creators, good teams, they could cut a lot of sort of like the guff out of it and have a leaner product, and it would be a lot better.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm all for, you know, do we really need this scene? What scene does this? Now I'm all for, like, you know, what I call Tony and the Ducks scenes, you know, where Tony Soprano used to go out and visit the ducks in his pool.
Yep.
I'm all for scenes like that because they tell you something about the character, and it's this quiet little moment between all the mayhem.
Hmm.
But that scene served a purpose. Every scene has to serve a purpose. And if it's just, you know, reiterating the high concept for the 80th time, it's like, ugh.
Yeah, I know. I agree, Chuck. Now, my co-host, Stu, is sick tonight and sadly not with us, but something we discuss a lot on the show, Chuck, is like creator rights and also creator-owned options. And I know it's a really complicated issue, and I might come across as naive, but I'm one of those people that thinks it's really wrong that movies and shows can sort of gut storylines from the comics and the creators potentially don't see a check for that. But, I mean, that's just my view from the outside as a spectator. And we were both wondering how a guy like yourself who's been around the block, been in the industry for decades, how do you view all that, and how do you compartmentalize all that, you know?
Well, you look back with a lot of regret. But the thing is, I mean, if you wanted to get in comics, you had to work for hire and work for hire. But to me, it's a concept that doesn't stand the constitutional test here in the United States, but nobody's challenged it in court. Jack Kirby's estate got close to it, and Marvel hurried up and settled because it was going to go to the Supreme Court.
They almost sat on the courtroom steps, didn't they? They almost did.
Yeah, exactly. But they were, next step was Supreme Court of the United States, and the question of work for hire was going to be determined. And that's the last thing the comic book publishers wanted. And it's unfair. It's not right. They make enough money off of these movies and TV shows. I mean, there's no money in comics. We're not asking for money from the comics. But, you know, when they use your concept on a TV show or a movie, you know, throw me a bone. Now, DC back in the day when Paul Levitz was running it, you could call him and say, hey, they use this element. I got money from Batman Begins for the scene where Bruce goes and picks out the Batmobile. He doesn't build it. He picks it out. And I'm the first writer that ever wrote that. And I called Paul and said, hey, what about it? And they sent me a check.
Okay.
You know, but today, no. You couldn't even get anybody to talk to you now.
It's really changed.
It's really changed.
Like, I mean, I work for a big corporation as well. And I know at the end of it, like, that's the problem. Like, I don't mean to sound depressing, but it really is. Like, the corporation at the end of the day, they don't want to pay out, you know, like... I know he had some discretion, but like the general rule will be we don't pay out what we don't have to pay out. You know, take us to court if you want. We've got deep pockets. That seems to be the general message, you know.
Well, you know, back when Paul and Jeanette Kahn were running DC and stuff, they were looking out for the family of comic book people, you know, the comic book freelancers.
Mm.
They were thinking of them because we're comic book people. We're looking out for comic book people.
Sure.
But now, you know, both the major companies are owned by Disney and
Warner's.
Warner's. And, you know, they don't care about comic book people. Comic book people are a dime a dozen. You know?
They're like, thank you for your ideas.
Yes.
That's handy.
Thank you. No. A thank you would imply they owe you something. You don't even get that. You get nothing. You know, they won't acknowledge that, hey, we took all of this dialogue from your comic and used it, or we took the storyline and used it. Mm. I mean, I see stuff all the time. I mean, people ask me, have you watched the Punisher Netflix show? Mm. And I'm like, you know, I can't watch it because
– yeah.
I'm going to be sitting there going, oh, they use this, they use that. They use, you know.
And that's sad, too, because, like, I'm not pressing you to watch it because I understand your reasons 100%. It is good, and he's a good actor.
Oh, yeah.
And they're doing a good job, you know?
It's absolutely perfect casting. When I saw him in Walking Dead, I thought, this guy would be a great Punisher.
Yeah, he's very good. And there's a story, apparently, where he was walking across Brooklyn Bridge at, like, 3 or 4 in the morning by himself to isolate himself to play the character.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff's cool, you know, like it's like...
That is cool.
Yeah. I wanted to ask, I think, have you got any plans to re-enter the creator-owned sphere? I think the last time we spoke, you mentioned a project at Dark Horse, a survivalist project. Have you got sort of...
No, it's at IDW. IDW, it's called Unprep. I think it comes out in October.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, I've got other stuff in the mix. I'm always working on stuff. I'm working on something with Bob Harden. We used to have magazines here called Cartoons and Cycletoons, and they were basically... It was basically Mad Magazine for hot rod enthusiasts, and Bob used to work for them. So
cool.
We're doing a project.
That's
we're
cool.
doing like our homage to 1970s car chase movies. So,
oh, nice. Cool.
Yeah.
Like,
and I got a couple other things in the mix. Alan Robinson and I are working on a Viking comedy, create our own thing.
Oh, cool.
So,
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you've got plenty of stuff. Now, Chuck, I want to run down the novels because I'm a huge fan of your novel work. Now, are you working on a new Levon Cade novel, I believe? Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm working on Levon's War, which will be the fifth Levon Cade
novel. That's an ominous tone. That's an ominous title.
Yeah.
Just for listeners who may not have encountered your novels, could you give the 10-second pitch on Levon, just for the listeners?
Levon Cade scratches my Punisher itch, basically. He used to be a United States Marine, but as they tell you, they're always Marines for life. But he's working as a security guy in Alabama. He's from Alabama and takes a job from his boss, which turns him into a vigilante. And, of course, that breaks every kind of federal and local law and becomes an outlaw on the run for the next few books.
With his daughter.
With his daughter, yeah, that's kind of what makes it different. He's got a 12-year-old daughter. Well, she grows older. I think she's 13 in the fifth book.
She
starts out being 11. Yeah, she's got a lot of birthdays, as she jokes in the book, because she's always got these new identities that he buys for her. So she gets a new birthday all the time. But it's vigilante action. It's shoot 'em up. It's bad guys die spitting blood.
I mean, and I recommend this. This is one where, Chuck, if you put this out monthly, I would read it monthly. Like, it is. I am totally hooked, and I'm sure many a Punisher fan and many a sort of vigilante fiction fan, I know they're out there on Amazon, are just devouring this. Now, you also recently released Blooded, which for me was a total page turner about a real estate agent turned vampire.
Yeah. That sounds so funny when you put it that way.
Well, yeah. Do you see a sequel in the future there, Chuck, for Blooded?
I mean, to me, it was a one-off.
Sure.
It was just an idea I got and just started sort of writing feverishly with this high-concept idea, and it just sort of, like, wrote itself. It's one thing led to another.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I might revisit it. I was thinking about it this week. Where would I go with it? Because I laid a lot of groundwork for a sequel.
Yeah. And you left it kind of open at the end without ruining the end. It's got, you know what I mean? It could lead straight into something if you wanted it to.
I gave it sort of a James M. Cain ending. But, you know, yeah, it's open to more books.
The one I always ask you about, Chuck, is Gomez. What a great zombie survivalist story. I love this story. Are we looking at any sequels there, Chuck?
Yeah, I got there's a mid mid-budget movie in the works based on the first one. And as we get closer to that, I'll put out a sequel.
Awesome.
I've already got a couple of ideas. And my wife came up with a great idea that I'm begging her to let me use.
You know what my girlfriend does? Because she's had a few ideas at times and titles off. She wants to get a co-writing credit.
Well, my wife came up a lot of times when I wrote The Simpsons. She was plotting it because, you know, I couldn't come up with plots. And she would go, did they ever do this? And she'd have the whole thing laid out.
That's helpful.
So I got her writing credits. So you can Google her and her writing credits.
Good for her.
She's amazing at high concept plots. And she comes up with stuff all the time. And I'm like, oh, man, I want to use that. I want to steal that.
I want to steal that now.
Yes.
That's a $1 million idea right there.
Oh, yeah. All the time. Just this amazing stuff. How do I want to write that?
I mean, Chuck, one of the great things I think about being a writer in today's world and being a novel writer is you can literally write a story, and you've done this, publish it either traditionally or through Amazon, and it gets straight to the public very fast, and you get the feedback real fast. It must be, you know, a powerful sort of thing for you as you move into the novel writing more and more.
Yeah, it's great not to have something. I don't need permission to write. That's the biggest thing. I don't have to pitch or anything like that. The only person to bounce the stuff off of is my editor, and you know, the weird thing is you can go on Kindle Direct Publishing and actually see how many pages have been read that day, so you can see people reading the book. That's so neat.
You can see, or sometimes it can be depressing.
Well, yeah, I got that too. But to me, it's like, you know, you write comics, you write novels, you send them out there, and you think, are they just sitting on somebody's table, not being looked at? But now I can see, oh, man, people are actually reading this.
Now, I wanted to ask you, with these novels, I'm always interested, because, as you know, I've written three myself. Do you keep to a conscious schedule of saying it's going to be two a year or three a year of your different series? Oh, and how conscious are you of the word count, or is it all completely organic for you? Like, you start when you want and finish when you want. Like, what's the process for you?
I sort of chip away at them because, for a while there, I was putting out a new novel every 60 days, but it slowed down because I got other paying work. So the Levon's War, you know, it's probably not going to be out till October. I wanted it out last month, but I've been chipping away. I'm over half done with it. And to me, 40,000 words is minimum for a novel. I don't write long novels.
Sure.
So 40,000 is minimum once I hit that. You know, I'm aiming at that mark, in other words. And I'm 26,000 words on Levon's War, and so I'll be able to wrap it up to get it out in October.
Listening to you talk makes me think my next novel could be a lot shorter. I could maybe just trim it down a bit. I could just say I've hit the 40.
But you're writing for a different audience. If I was writing epic fantasy, you got to get the word count up there. But I'm writing, but even for thrillers, mine are short. But I grew up on, you know, paperbacks in the 60s, and they were 120, 150 pages long. You know, they weren't.
Yeah,
you know, you read them in an afternoon. You didn't carry them around with you for months.
Yeah, they weren't like Tolkien or Game of Thrones or something. You know, they were hurting your back.
Fantasy by the pound.
I know exactly what you mean. Now, Chuck, as we sort of move towards wrapping up, what about the current crop of sort of Marvel and DC movies? Did you catch Wonder Woman, for example? Do you have an interest in those kind of things? You still check in?
I will probably see Wonder Woman when it comes out, you know, on video. I don't really go to the movie theaters that much, but I prefer the Marvel movies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I love Doctor Strange. That was awesome.
It was very good,
Looking forward to the Guardians of the Galaxy 2, and you know, those I think capture the mood better. But I hear good things about the Wonder Woman movie, so I definitely will see that.
Definitely worth a watch, man. It's enjoyable. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm not, you know, as thrilled by what I've seen on the Justice League movie. That looks like a train wreck. But you know, I just don't think I don't think DC doesn't have, or Warner's doesn't have they don't have the guys that Marvel has, you know, that are trying to stay true to the material.
Yeah, I hear you, man. Like, the Marvel movies, like, say, Civil War, they're very good at taking a concept that was in the comics and then sort of going their own way with it, but still sort of staying true to it. They're very good at getting the spirit of the Enterprise, if you know what I mean.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I mean, in the Doctor Strange movie, there was enough of the iconic imagery, the Ditko imagery, that made me happy.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they presented Strange the way I remembered him in the comic. You know, maybe a little bit more humor, but you know, that's not a problem either. I mean, Doctor Strange was probably the most humorless character Marvel ever did. So.
Yeah, I liked him in the movie. I'm not a Doctor Strange comic guy, but I thought the movie was really interesting and cool.
I'm a huge Doctor Strange fan. I loved it.
Now, what about over at Disney as well with Star Wars? We've got Episode 8 coming out and the Han Solo prequel. Are you a Star Wars guy?
I'm a recovering Star Wars fan. You couldn't find a bigger Star Wars fan than me, and then the prequels just kind of beat it out of me.
They're horrible. They're basically horrible. Yeah.
And now there's a lot of political correctness going on. And virtue signaling with the new movies. I mean, I saw Rogue One and I enjoyed it enough. I had problems with it, but I enjoyed it enough.
I actually think that the Disney deal was probably the best thing to happen in the Star Wars franchise because it was just dying, itself, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's money sitting there waiting to be made, and there's a ready audience, and people love the characters, so why not do them? I mean, the idea of waiting decades between trilogies is crazy.
It's just nuts.
So, yeah.
I
a yearly Star Wars film, it's like, yeah, that's a great idea.
Mm. Now, Chuck, basically we're wrapping up. I've got a big question for you. When it comes to music, are you a streaming kind of guy? Do you buy vinyl records? Are you a hipster? Or do you like the trusty old CD?
I just load a bunch of stuff on iTunes and just put it on shuffle.
Just go crazy. And,
yeah, just whatever comes up. It's like my own radio station.
I like it because I was just recently, I spent a weekend away, a Sydney Railway tour of New Zealand with some people, and the thing that kept coming up every now and then was how we consume music. And there was a 10-minute conversation where three people just wouldn't stop about how great vinyl records were and how much they love it. And eventually I said, just cutting in, guys, has it radically changed? Because I remember putting a record on. It was real scratchy. You couldn't move around. Like, has this changed? They're like, oh, no, that hasn't changed. I go, yeah, well, I'm completely out. It's like, I don't get the vinyl. Like, I get that it's a hipster thing, but I don't really get the it's so great thing, you know?
I grew up with vinyl, and, I mean, I gave up on it in the 70s. I mean, I just... The records were – the quality was so terrible. And, you know, maybe you like listening to music with an ambient hiss in the background. I do.
I'm the same. I'm like, why is that a plus?
it's a richer sound than everything else. Yeah. You're out of your mind.
I was talking to my sister. She's an audiologist, okay? And she said, like, the thing is, like, it has the peaks and troughs, and then the CD sort of moderates out, as does the digital. She goes, there's no real difference that a normal person can pick up at all it any better whatsoever. It's in the
plus you can adjust your equalizer to what you want it to be. You can change the sound on a computer or whatever. Why do you need vinyl? I gave my records away in the 80s. Take them.
I was the worst person at this table. I was the bad guy who'd given all my CDs away, just had Apple Music. I'm like, I'm basically the bad guy here. You guys are sitting around like, I don't have to store anything. It's all on a phone.
I just like the surprise element where you just put it on shuffle and whatever comes up,
exactly.
And I know I'm going to like it because I put it in there.
Exactly. It's your own greatest hits.
Exactly. And then you go, I remember this, and then with me, it's eclectic. It could be anything. It could be, it could be the Muffs 1 minute and Frank Sinatra the next. So.
Oh, you can never go past Frank. I mean, just today I was listening to some Frank and he can never go past him. For me, it's Frank and Bob Dylan with a bit of Johnny Cash,
Hey, we could party.
All right, Chuck. Now, have you got anything else coming out that you'd like to promote or tell listeners about as we get to the end of this interview? Have you got anything else?
I got a bunch of stuff in the works I can't talk about yet. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about it next time.
Excellent. Well, Chuck, thank you so much for your time and all the best, okay?
Well, thank you, David. You're a prince.
See you, mate.